Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 11 days, Ohio ends its fiscal year in the black, thanks to some underspending. But a weak stream of state revenue has forced cuts and prompted Senate Republicans to slash $1 billion from the pending two-year state budget. Democrats have another idea: get rid of the small business tax break that costs the state about $1 billion a year. Welcome to our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us by phone, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Jessica Wehrman. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Hi, good morning. Thanks, Ian.
Also, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, good morning.
And Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Chrissy Thompson. Welcome back, Chrissy.
Hey there.
Jessica, let's turn to you first for some news from last week. Something that is close, I don't know if close to your heart is the right thing, but certainly something that affected you personally because you live in Alexandria, the shooting there. Tell us, what is the latest? How is everybody doing and how did it affect you?
Well, so the latest is, basically that Whip Scalise, his condition is improving. Actually, while he was shot in the hip, those were injuries that when he was sent to the hospital were actually considered possibly fatal. The hip's a really strange place to be shot. There's a lot of organs coming together there. The bullet actually sort of went up into those organs, caused a lot of internal bleeding and that sort of thing. But he has improved. He was in multiple surgeries. I actually talked to his roommate at the congressional baseball game on Thursday night, and that's John Shimkus of Illinois. He said he'd been through a lot of surgeries, but he seemed to be on the mend, and they confirmed that this weekend that he's actually improving, in good spirits, that sort of thing. As for the other folks who were injured in that, some remain hospitalized, but it seems like everyone is in pretty good condition. The reason this is a very interesting story for me was this actually occurred less than a mile from my house. I have spent hours of my life at this park. It's got a dog run. My kids play soccer. My kids play baseball. So it's just a place that we have been a lot. I mean, it's basically a place that we've spent hours of our life at. So it kind of hit home. I mean, you can walk to it from my house. I've covered crime before. I covered September 11th. But this is sort of a unique experience because, that park in many ways feels like home.
How does it feel now?
I was there last night or yesterday afternoon for a baseball game. I will be there again tonight for a baseball game. These are Little League games.
Yeah, they go on all summer.
Really do. And Little League isn't like soccer. It's like 2 or 3 hours of...
I know.
Yeah, you're there.
Been there, done that.
So, it's strange because, we were playing another team and you could kind of see the other team sort of paying attention to this park as you're coming in because all of a sudden this park that nobody ever really thought much of is like the scene of this big national news story. You don't really see much evidence of it being, of it being a crime scene recently. Now, that said, I haven't gone over to the YMCA, of which I'm a member. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know what it's looking like over there. I don't know if they've managed to replace the glass because there were bullet holes in several places in that front window, or if the bullet holes still remain and they have yet to replace it. But everything's up and running. It was sort of strange through Sunday, and then they kind of opened up the streets around there on Saturday. There's a little grocery store called Aldi across the street. There's a CVS. So there's a lot of stuff there that had been closed for a matter of days.
This was supposed, some people said immediately in the aftermath that this is going to unify, this is going to bring Congress together, this is what, sadly, I mean, something like this needed to jar them back into some kind of working relationship with each other. But then just as quickly others said, heck to that, no, that's not happening. What's your sense about Congress at this point, Monday morning, bright and early?
Well, there have been a lot of windows of possibility of tragedy actually bringing folks together in the past, and they have not taken advantage of this. I mean, I hate to call them opportunities because they're tragedies.
Yeah.
And everyone doesn't want these things to happen. I mean, when Gabrielle Giffords was shot, John Boehner was among those who was in tears on the floor of the House, and he is a Republican and she is a Democrat. There are times when, these things happen and they should be moments of unity, and they don't become that because this is really, this is fundamentally a town about kind of keeping your job and hanging on to your job and hanging on to power in any way possible. And it's frustrating. And it's frustrating, too, because you talk to members of Congress who say they don't like the way this works. They don't want to be demonized for their political beliefs, and they don't really want to demonize others, but they kind of feel like it's appropriate because, you know, hey, they're getting it, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting is, I mean, we always talk about the tone. This is just, I mean, it feels like a cliche to even mention the tone. But what's interesting is sort of the level of demonization against people who happen to disagree with you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that's been increasingly frustrating, just to see, you know, maybe you don't agree on such and such, but perhaps there's some common ground you can find elsewhere. But it's really hard to find, you know, people are very locked into whatever ideologies they've decided to identify themselves as. And that makes it very difficult. And the rhetoric and tone is so personal. One of the letters I got actually from somebody who's written to me in the past was somebody who said, well, you know, this is the mainstream media's fault. And I said, you know, maybe we shouldn't talk about fault. Maybe that's not the best way to talk about this. Maybe the way maybe the thing to do instead is to try to find some understanding and some common ground. I you know, that sounds very Pollyannish, but it's just it's very hard to watch things not actually getting done here. And it's not, I mean, this isn't a new dynamic. This has been going on for several years. Very
right.
Basic stuff, like stuff that if I didn't do these things for my job, I would not have a job. But what's actually even harder is sort of seeing people being sort of demonizing each other just because they happen to disagree.
And then paying, you know, worst case scenario with their life for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I disagree with my husband over a lot of stuff, but, you know, and I disagree with a lot of people.
That was a nervous yeah. chuckle.
But, I mean, but the idea of, you know, a disagreement being yeah. something that worth being violent for is just, it's completely a foreign idea to me. I don't understand it at all. So I think that's the weirder part. I mean, and, you know, in this neighborhood, it's a neighborhood where kind of everyone, I mean, this is a company town, right? So
mm-hmm.
people are in some way involved with Congress or the government or the executive branch or something or that, or they're lobbying. And, you know, they come from, I mean, in the group of people I know, they really range across ideologies. And we don't really talk about politics when we're hanging out because that's what we do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So, we managed to make it work here. And so that was kind of a strange, I mean, to say it's strange seems to sort of understate
mm-hmm.
what a surreal week it was.
That's Jessica Wehrman. She's Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Chrissy Thompson from the Cincinnati Enquirer. Andy Chow?
Yeah, I think what Jessica's saying is really interesting because, you know, like we're seeing, there is not a lot of camaraderie or unity happening when it comes to policymaking right now. We still see the health care bill
this
moving through.
This is similar. There's an echo of it, certainly in Ohio.
Right. And so, but what I do wonder, so again, we're not seeing the unity as far as policymaking right now. But what I do wonder what could come out of this is maybe, hopefully, people watching the words they say a little more carefully. And because, you know, we've been to rallies from both parties where things seem to be dialed up to 11, and it seems like people aren't really worried about the words that they use. And so maybe this will have people just looking through what they say before they say it to make sure that they're not ratcheting up the wrong crowd.
Jessica Wehrman, another issue in Washington that affects people in Ohio, they're grappling with it at the budget level here as well, is health care. A Senate committee is working in secret on a bill.
Yeah.
What do we know?
Yeah, so they are working, and Senator Portman's among those who's involved in this, but, you know, they're being pretty tight-lipped about exactly what they want to do. Now, Portman kind of showed his hand a little bit last week when he sort of suggested he's been he really opposed the House bill because of the way it affected Medicaid and the Medicaid population. But
mm-hmm.
then last week he sort of suggested, well, you know, maybe we can sort of dial down the Medicaid expansion over a period of time, which is kind of a big development for him because
mm-hmm.
before he had seemed sort of like this is not going to happen. They want to have a bill done by the end of next week before they go on 4th of July recess. So I think things are going to move kind of fast and furious. At the same time, Schumer saying, hey, you know, the Democratic leader is saying, let's get all 100 Democrat, all 100 senators into a room, into the Senate, old Senate chamber. We can all hash this out. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, things are just really fluid right now in terms of exactly how this plays out. But I would expect to see something being voted on before next Friday. Not this Friday, but next Friday.
Speaking of Senator Portman, Governor Kasich has now said, right, Chrissy Johnson, that he's kind of okay, maybe.
You know, so I'm trying to remember the first time Governor Kasich said this. I remember tweeting about it. It was probably several months ago because he has opposed every version of this federal health
because
bill.
Of Medicaid expansion.
That's right. But he has said multiple times and reaffirmed this last week that he would support or would be willing to see Medicaid expansion phased out slowly over a period of several years. He's gone back and forth, right? Once he said something like, you know, phasing it down to the federal match. Current proposals would just get rid of it. The federal match, just to be clear, right now they're getting more. The government is paying for almost all of the health care for the federal government is for the Medicaid expansion population, which are generally childless adults who are under the federal poverty line. That's a super general definition there. But he might be willing to even accept it if it was phased down completely over a period of years. It's interesting to know that he wouldn't be governor anymore when that goes into effect. But I think it is more to it than that for him. But I think certainly that is a factor. This is something that he wants to see there on his watch, you know, and the bottom line is that whoever is governor after Kasich is going to have a lot of different philosophies on many things. I mean, even his lieutenant governor, who's running for governor now, Mary Taylor, doesn't agree with him on all of the healthcare stuff he's done. So in some ways, maybe it's a tacit acknowledgement by Kasich that whoever's next is going to make a lot of changes to the state anyway. So,
and then keep in mind, right now, Ohio is already facing a budget shortfall of more than $800 million, and that's not including anything that could potentially happen to Medicaid. So meanwhile, while Ohio is trying to fill this budget gap of more than $800 million, if Congress were to pass something that changes Medicaid expansion and the funding to Medicaid, that would be a yet another really big gap that Ohio would have to deal with.
Or start to eliminate the coverage at the state level.
Yep, or take people out of Medicaid.
Jessica Weirman, how much do we know about how much the Senate's reaching out to the nation's governors who deal with this on the ground?
I mean, they've worked together a little bit on this in the past, but I think that right now this is all sort of the Senate's deal. And I know that Kasich last week joined a bunch of governors in writing a letter regarding this, but I think that their focus is on getting something that they can pass. So, I mean, is it interesting input to them? Yes. Is it sort of deal killer or deal maker? No.
Mm-hmm. One thing we have seen also is that there's some suggestion that Portman might support this as well. Deirdre Shesky, my colleague, was writing about this, I think, last week, that they could increase by a lot the funding for the heroin and opioid epidemic for treatment for that kind of in exchange. Someone like a Kasich might be more open to that because he believes that Medicaid expansion is the primary tool the state uses to fight the opioid and heroin epidemic because it can pay for treatment for people who are on the
plan.
Well,
it's considered the most efficient method to handle the treatment payments.
I think I saw a statistic that said that roughly 30% of those with opioid use disorder use Medicaid to pay for.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was there was a hearing with Portman last week, and I mean that's a huge, that's a huge number. You can't underestimate the value of Medicaid to helping to treat opioid use disorders.
Yeah, and so if we think about it that way, we won't know what the number is right until it comes out, but it would have to be an awful lot of heroin and opioid treatment money to make up for the loss of the Medicaid expansion coverage for folks who need it because of their addiction. So I personally, I don't know, Jess might have more perspective, but it's hard to see how that spread across 50 states would make up for the loss of that coverage. But maybe it helps at least for folks around the fence.
I mean, when you talk about how are people covered under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of it is Medicaid. I mean, so much of it is Medicaid. And that's not just applying to those with opioid use disorder. But, I mean, that's been a very major tool in fighting it. It's hard to imagine that any sort of number that they're going to come up with would be sufficient to offset the loss that you would receive from, you know, rolling back the Medicaid expansion.
Right, right.
We're going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporters roundtable by phone. Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. With me here in the studio, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable, and we were talking about health care, the Affordable Care Act in the United States. A Senate committee is busy at work, secretly working on a bill that they're going to roll out and hopefully vote, and they hope to vote on before they leave for their 4th of July recess. With us by phone, Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Chrissy Thompson of the she's Columbus Bureau Chief at the Cincinnati Inquirer. So, Jessica Wehrman, you're saying they hope. I mean, so the Senate votes on this whatever they're working on now before they leave for 4th of July. Then they all come back, and do they have a conference committee? How does that work?
There's going to have to be some sort of conference committee because the plan, as it passed the House, would not pass the Senate. So they're going to have to come together and come up with some sort of agreement or amendment that would pass through the House again, which means, and remember, that was a squeaker that AHCA bill.
Right.
It was like 7 votes or something.
In the House, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it barely passed the House. And it was a controversial vote, so they're going to have to find a way to make sure. They really threaded a needle, honestly, to get that bill passed because, you know, you have the Freedom Caucus, which is enough of a chunk of Republican members that if they vote against something, it's just not going to pass because you're not going to get the Democrats to vote for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have the Tuesday group, which is a little bit more moderate. They managed to find consensus on it. So this is going to be I'm really curious as to A, what the Senate passes, and B, how the House is going to react to whatever they pass. Like, what's the final thing going to look like?
Is there any sense that the Trump administration is in on all of this?
It is so hard to kind of figure out what exactly, because on one hand, President Trump was very gung-ho. I mean, you'll remember when they passed it, he had this White House ceremony right afterwards talking about what a victory it was. But then with Portman went over to the White House last week, and he apparently told the senators that it was a mean bill. So I don't really know. I think he wants something passed, you know, just so he can kind of say, this is a promise that I delivered on. We have changed fundamentally Obamacare. But I don't think that the nuance is really really something he's as concerned about.
He hasn't seemed to care about the content of the bill. The bill doesn't do some of the other things he said he might do, and he's just kind of been...
He wants to check the box.
Yeah, yeah. He seemed to be just like, well, we got rid of Obamacare, so yay.
Well, how... So at the state level, though, this affects state finances, as you mentioned. I mean, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The Medicaid piece of the state budget is huge and immutable unless something changes at the federal level when it comes to Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, and going back to the heroin and opioid epidemic, every time we ask the Kasich administration about what they're doing to stem that problem, they point to Medicaid expansion as a huge tool in this fight. And so if that were to be pulled away from the state, it would leave a big question mark of how we're going to pay for the approximately 700,000 people who have gained health care under the Affordable Care Act and expanded Medicaid. And again, it would leave a huge gap in the budget aside from the $800 million that we're already facing. And what Republicans and what Governor Kasich has said is if Medicaid expansion were to be taken away, if the laws under the Affordable Care Act were to be repealed, the state would not be able to fill that funding gap. So people would, according to the Kasich administration, people would lose their health care because of it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about what the state would do if it were gone, because Andy was pointing this out earlier, the House version, and Jess, correct us if we're wrong here, but 2020 was when that phase out would happen. And so Kasich's not going to be governor again at that point. Okay. And there are a lot of Republicans in the legislature, at least, who don't want to have done this. They don't want to have expanded Medicaid, and they would like to get rid of it now. There's even bills to start the phase out in Ohio now. Which Kasich would veto, P.S. But anyway, say it's gone. On principle, a lot of these Republicans don't want to cover these. They just don't want to expand a state-run healthcare program. Okay. But they also have started to admit, like, we need to do more to fight the heroin epidemic with treatment money. Generally speaking, what they have done over the last few years has been very small tweaks to bills related to overdose drugs and where you can carry them, and related to sentencing and other law enforcement sorts of things for people who use
treatment
heroin or
versus
deal
sentencing.
It.
And that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so advocates have said over and over again, the only way to save lives is to spend money on treatment. This drug, once you take it, changes your brain chemistry, and yep, you must have medication-assisted treatment. This is how we stop this epidemic. And so they're really starting to say now, okay, the Republicans are really starting to kind of acknowledge that we need more money. You get rid of this program, and they honestly haven't thrown a lot of money at it yet, right? Where in the world are they going to come up with the billions of dollars that we need for treatment? We already know
in the worst state in the country, by the way.
Right.
Correct. And on a pure numbers basis, we have more heroin overdose deaths than anyone else.
You always want to be number one, but maybe not in that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. Not
yeah.
Good.
Exactly.
That's maybe the exception to the rule.
And it's like if you're playing a game, if you're playing football, and you can have all these other elements going on, and you can have good blocking and good pass rush, but if you're not doing the big thing you need to do, if you're not scoring touchdowns or scoring points. And with this, people have said what we're doing right now as far as raising awareness, doing the Narcan treatment. Mm-hmm. But the big thing, the thing that has to happen is this medication assistant treatment. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it has to happen, according to studies, it has to happen right away. And what other states are doing, what Rhode Island is doing that Ohio hasn't quite picked up on yet, but it seems to be the best practices, when somebody is sent to the emergency room and they're treated for an overdose and they're saved, so their life was saved, in that bed, in that emergency room bed, somebody comes up to them and talks to them and says, we are enrolling you into medication-assisted treatment, or we need you to sign on and agree to medication-assisted treatment. And from there on, they are put on a path towards treatment. And that's not happening. People are going, their life is being saved, and they're going back home. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting that intervention and that treatment. And that treatment costs a lot of money. But that's what reports and what studies have said, is that's the way you fight this.
Yeah.
The intelligence hearings continue in Washington, Jessica Wehrman. Yeah. Apparently Republicans, I think it's in the House, are pivoting to consider former Attorney General Loretta Lynch and her role in the email issue with Hillary Clinton's campaign. What's going on?
Well, I mean, the changing the conversation dynamic continues. Mm-hmm. They are having a hearing, I think, on Tuesday, and we do have Ohio does have two, by the way. I need to mention lawmakers who are on the House Intelligence Committee. We don't have anyone on the Senate Intelligence Committee. We've got Mike Turner and Brad Wenstrup on there. They're looking at Loretta Lynch. They're still trying to bring up the email thing because they're trying to change the conversation. This is sort of a drip, 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 but it's that actually kind of, again, understates it, because we just sort of get more information every day. I mean, from yesterday's appearance by Jay Sekulow, who's President Trump's attorney, saying, no, we're not under investigation, to Trump himself tweeting on Friday, no, I'm under investigation. It's kind of almost hard to sort of keep it straight, and it's such a fast-moving process that... you kind of need like a map.
You know,
is it
fast moving? I mean, people say that this could take months, if not years.
When I say fast moving, I'm talking about the developments. There's things that keep coming out. Now, do I say that these investigations will conclude? No, because there's a couple. I mean, you've got the congressional, and then you've also got the special prosecutor.
Right.
Now, the special prosecutor seems to be moving kind of fast. I mean, there's a lot. That seems to be really proceeding apace. The House and Senate Intelligence Committee hearings, you know, they're very big and they're very newsy, but I don't know that they're culminating. They're not coming to a head yet, as it was. So,
you know, one question I wanted to ask about healthcare and also, you know, these hearings is to talk about the politics for just a minute. I mean, is the resolving the healthcare, at least at the Senate level, all important because they want to be able to go back and campaign over the 4th of July holiday, that they want to be able to go back and put that on their resume when they're running for reelection?
Well, it's still a little bit early to, I mean, you're always in campaign mode here, but
yeah.
I think that's not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is just kind of getting it off the plate so you can sort of move and change the conversation to things like tax reform,
mm-hmm.
things, the other things that are on the list of campaign promises to check off. If you move past this, you can do some of these other things. Infrastructure, you know, why not? Or tax reform. They keep talking about it, but nothing's really been pushed forward yet because, you know, healthcare is this giant, giant thing that's sitting there, this elephant in the room. And meanwhile, they're trying to do some sort of policy as well to change the conversation about Russia, because it's become such a sort of a constant drumbeat over
mm-hmm.
here that if you're actually doing something policy-wise, perhaps that sort of distracts from the politics stuff that's going on.
What about in Ohio? I mean, do you see people running on these issues like they do every 2 years for re-election in the House, at least?
Okay, so these issues are, it's a little broad, but like things that I see that have national echoes. I mean, you see folks still running on trying to get rid of Medicaid expansion, like voting. We have some... I would use the word far right wing, I guess, Republicans who like to talk about how they're voting no on budget bills and things like that because it still includes Medicaid and they will vote no on that. There's others who are taking approaches such as introducing bills or trying to finagle. There's some language that could get held up in courts that is in the House version of the budget, you know, over basically trying to find new ways to tie the administration's hands on using Medicaid money from the government to pay for people's coverage. So you see that. We have some folks in Ohio who are trying to get involved in the discussion, at least, over refugees, over they would say that relates to terrorism. Over who we allow in our country and in our cities. Josh Mandel is honestly one who comes to mind. He has really tried to adopt that issue. And also Donald Trump's, you see a lot of Trump-esque tweets from
yeah.
Josh Mandel about how bad the media is and calling out different stories as being spun against him in a mean way. So trying to pick up on those issues, the issues of media bias, and he's also been quite vocal in his role as state treasurer, interestingly enough, about whether we should have whether we as cities should continue not police departments should we most many of our police departments do not call ICE if they find it.
These would be what? Sanctuary.
That's right. So it's
actions.
To be a sanctuary city, you I'm just trying to define it without using the word, but yes, to be a sanctuary city, you would tell your police department, like, don't call federal immigration officers or ICE if you pick somebody up who you find is in the country illegally.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our problem. And he would like to cut down on that here in Ohio. And there's some lawmakers who have signed on with that effort, too.
Keeping in mind that Columbus has basically adopted those provisions that Chrissy just said.
Right.
They don't want to. They haven't come out and said we are a sanctuary city, but they have adopted similar provisions to a sanctuary city. I think what we're going to see politically is a lot of people, especially on the Republican side, try to adopt the kind of things that President Trump attached himself to when he was running in 2016. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing to see is I just don't think that's going to resonate with voters in 2018 as much as it did in 2016. One, I don't think you can tap into the charisma and the personality that Donald Trump has. I think there's only one Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that somebody like Treasurer Josh Mandel will be able to act exactly like Donald Trump and get his point across.
Yep.
So issues like immigration that used to be big, I don't know if it's going to work that well in 2018. What I think we will, and I know I keep going to this, but I think the big issue, especially in the governor's race, is going to be the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. And what are people going to do about it? And I moderated an event with Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper and Franklin County Republican Chair Brad Sennett. And they were very collegial, and they bounced back and forth on a lot of ideas, and they weren't really going at it a lot. But when it came to the opioid crisis, that's when there was a big fight over what the state should do about it, what has the state done about it. And I think that the current administration, the Kasich administration, is going to be criticized or be under scrutiny, or will be scrutinized by what they have done. And the Republicans will say, we are on the right path. We have been doing the right thing. We're trying to get this done. The Democrats are going to say, we are not on the right path. This has been bungled, and we need to change direction.
Jessica Weirman, just to play off that, I mean, is this, we know the president has said that he's not interested in deporting Dreamers now, that is people who were brought to the United States as children and who have grown up here as Americans. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of pushback about that. His base seems to be okay with that now.
He said that, but you know, what he does and what he says are sometimes different things. You do hear about people who are getting deported who are, not necessarily Dreamers, but moms with kids here. There is the deportations that appear to have at least gone up. That, or they're being paid more attention to than perhaps they were in the Obama administration. I am kind of interested in watching sort of long-term how that plays out, because, again, we're focused on health care. We're focused on tax reform. Mm-hmm. The immigration stuff, the wall, has not really – it's not come to a head yet. I mean, it's still something that's sort of – it's a rhetoric that's out there, but it hasn't really become a reality beyond sort of making sort of heightened enforcement of immigration laws. And, and mind you, the immigration system has been broken for years. There's been a need to reform this for years. All you need to do for that is to go up to the immigration courts and see the sheer caseload that they're managing on a day-to-day basis. This wall, I haven't seen it. There's been some discussion over it, but it's not anywhere near becoming a reality. There is heightened enforcement, Actually, I wanted to play on one other thing in terms of the politics. One thing to watch if you're super nerdy like I am about politics is this Georgia congressional race.
Mm-hmm.
I will be very curious. Now, we always try to really read a lot into special elections and go, this really means people are...
They were doing it back in Montana a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and sort of trying to figure out whether or not this means something larger. Not necessarily, but it's still worth paying attention to, because you're seeing some of Trump's base kind of going, maybe this isn't – this is. I mean, some are still very, very diehard and very supportive. Mm-hmm. How dare you not support him? Others, I think, are maybe a little bit more skeptical than they have been in the past.
In other words, more tolerant of people who don't fall in lockstep with Trump. Yeah. We'll continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. With us by phone, Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Chrissy Thompson from the Cincinnati Enquirer. Jessica Wehrman, I want to talk about Otto Warmbier. He's the Ohio student who was arrested in North Korea for taking a propaganda poster off of a hotel wall. Mm-hmm. He's been in custody. Then they released him last week in a coma that they said was caused by botulism. The U.S. authorities have now said, no, that's not what caused this coma. What do we know right now about how the U.S. is responding to this?
I think this kind of continues sort of the thread against North Korea. I mean, usually there are exceptions that are made for medical emergencies, and yeah. This is not a medical emergency. I'm not really sure what is. I read something on him today. I know that there was a lot of backdoor State Department work to make this happen, and the fact that it even happened was progress. But I think that we're going to see sort of a renewed focus on North Korea as a threat. Now, not just because of him. There's a lot of stuff with North Korea that sort of means that we need to watch out for North Korea. But, I mean, I think this sort of, for a lot of people, kind of brings home the degree to which they're a threat. I mean, this was really inhumane treatment of this man, whether it was botulism or whether they beat him up. Or, I mean, he has serious brain tissue loss from everything that I have reported or everything that I've heard.
Chrissy Thompson, you wrote about this last week. What are plans?
It's really interesting when Jess brings up like backdoor State Department work. This is how we have traditionally handled detainees in North Korea is officials are told, don't talk about this. We don't want this in the news. We don't want North Korea to get mad because they could injure our citizens who are prisoners there, which typically doesn't happen. They typically treat them decently well with some mental abuse type stuff, but like physically they want to keep them in pretty good health because they try to use them as political bargaining chips. So the approach has always been the State Department will handle this through our intermediary, which right now is Sweden. We also have some private citizens who do some work. For instance, you all may remember former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. Before that, he was a UN ambassador, and he has for President Clinton. And this is what he does in his time now, as he negotiates for the release of prisoners who are U.S. citizens who are in countries that are hostile to the U.S. So anyway, I've heard a lot of folks again, and a lot of them weren't willing to say this. Some people would say it with a quote next to their name, but some of them weren't willing to because they've been told not to talk, but really saying this didn't work. Like, if this isn't bad treatment, I don't know what is. And like, it doesn't get any worse than this. So maybe we should change our approach. Maybe we should advocate more publicly for these folks' release. Maybe we should pressure China more publicly. China, you're allied with North Korea. You, China, do not want to be seen as a human rights abuser. But look what just happened on your friend's watch. You know, maybe we should be more vocal at the UN about we have sanctions on North Korea, but China sometimes vetoes harsh sanctions toward North Korea. So that discussion is ongoing. At the same time, we have to be careful because we don't want North Korea to nuke Seoul. You know, I mean, that is
bad.
An issue. So, but Jess is right. There's been a lot of conversation about maybe we should change our approach.
I don't think people understand, too. I mean, I was actually talking to Tony Hall and Dave Hobson, both of whom were very involved in North Korea for various reasons, with Tony Hall involved in hunger issues and Hobson more involved in sort of the nuclear issues.
Former congressman,
yep. When they were back in Congress. Mm-hmm. And Tony Hall was saying, you know, you actually can see Seoul. So when we talk about attacking, regardless of whether it's a nuclear attack or any even conventional weapons, it's not. I mean, this is really, really geographically close. So if they were to attack South Korea, I mean, this would not be a difficult stretch for them by any means.
It wouldn't be difficult, but, I mean, attacking Seoul or South Korea is like almost like attacking itself.
Almost. But I mean, you know, saving face is a very important part of sort of the national culture there. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very delicate about how you talk about North Korea. You don't want to be too insulting because these things that might not, you know, might not phase others are extremely sensitive in Korea.
And it seems like it's a very delicate balancing act where, I mean, we're talking about publications in Ohio writing about this, and you would think, oh, well, North Korea are not going to be paying attention to what outlets in Ohio write about, but they are. And it's in this world where we're all connected and interconnected with the news cycle. Like Chrissy was saying, any source who puts themselves out there for any news outlet, it can get back to another country.
Chrissy Thompson, the prognosis for Otto Warmbier, I mean, not good, and they still don't know what did cause it.
Right. So, okay. So deductive reasoning tells you it's not good. They will not comment officially on his prognosis.
Right.
But I believe, according to brain scans that the Koreans did provide when they sent him home, they didn't give an explanation of what had happened beyond this botulism thing, which there's no sign that he's had botulism. And you wouldn't give a sleeping pill if he had botulism. So anyway, we don't really know what happened. So they've sent home these brain scans, which indicate that he's had this brain injury for more than a year. So I don't know if there was anything that could have been done a year ago, but the time to do that has passed. And he continues to lose brain tissue, as Jess said. So he his eyes open, he has spontaneous movements, but nothing purposeful. It doesn't appear to know what's going on around him, that kind of thing. But he is well nourished and breathes on his own. It's just a really tough situation. So, and when they say well nourished, I, as far as I can tell, I think this is like a feeding tube type situation. So, and as far as what happened, this kind of brain tissue loss is caused when there is an interruption of oxygen to the brain. There's a variety of things that can cause that. One is a drug overdose. That's a possibility. But there's a lot of other things. You know, you could have cardiac arrest, which would, you know, cause the body to stop circulating fresh oxygenated blood up there. He doesn't really have any signs of severe physical injury. So it's likely something else, but
something starved oxygen to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The legal battle has been going on for more than a year now regarding the electronic classroom of tomorrow. The Ohio Supreme Court now has ruled that ECOT has to pay the $60 million that the State Department of Education says it owes for students who have not been showing up to class online. Andy Chow, where are we at right now?
Well, the State Board of Education voted last week to say, okay, ECOT, you need to give us our money back. ECOT is now saying that vote was inappropriate on certain grounds. I mean, the argument here is that basically ECOT and the Ohio Department of Education had a contract as to what it meant to fulfill their enrollment. Mm-hmm. And as long as they followed these certain rules, then they should get their money. ECOT saying, well, we followed the old rules. We played by the old rules. And so we should get our money. And they're saying that the Ohio Department of Education changed the rules. And by that, I mean that the Ohio Department of Education looked way more closely into how many students are logging on every day, how many hours are they spent logged on learning every day. And because of that, they found that I believe only 40% of the students that they said were full-time students were full-time students. Mm-hmm. So they got $100 million in funding, and ECOT's being told that they need to give $60 million back. Right now, it seems like that this is close to being a done deal, that ECOT has to give the money back because it's gone through the courts. Like you said, the courts have ruled in the Ohio Department of Education's favor. It's gone through a separate hearing held by the State Board of Education. So right now, it seems like ECOT is really in the position where it just has to give this money back. The interesting thing is this fight has been going on for a long time now, and a new school year is about to start. And the state is sending ECOT that money too. And now ECOT will once again have to prove that they did have the full-time students that they said that they had.
The state can't just withhold $60 million in funding?
Well, I don't believe they have at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure when that money is going to go to them. But it's fair to say that the state's going to keep a close eye on ECOT and make sure that they do have the full-time students that they say they have. So this is whatever happens to the $60 million this year or not, this is the ECOT's going to be under a microscope for the next few years now.
I mean, I think it's important to note that in the context of a budget, which, you know, approaches for 2 years, like $70 billion, that $60 million is not a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. So Andy's right. This is about the money, but it's also about the principle. It's about there will be consequences if this is continued to run this way.
But ECOT is saying they can't sustain a $60 million hit like this. And some Republican lawmakers have suggested graduated payments, mm-hmm, or
some sort of phasing in
some
or
some payment plan.
Yes, a plan where they can pay a little bit off over time. Mm-hmm. And so that there is a bill in the state house that would do that. I don't know how much support that's actually getting. I think a lot of people see it as, well, we're treating you like other schools, we're treating you like other businesses, and you said that you were going to have this many students, so we gave you the money for this many students, and you didn't have those students, so you need to give the money back. This has been a fight that's been going on for a while, not just this ECOT fight, but this online charter right. school fight.
Has there been any fundamental change in how ECOT records attendance by its students now?
Well, ECOT has been saying that, like, listen, we'll follow your rules. We just need to know what the rules are. So I think it's a fair bet going forward that they are going to keep ECOT themselves are going to keep a closer eye on the login information and how many students are logging in at a time. I do think that they have created new systems. The old system, from what I heard in hearings, was just a teacher would be asked, did this student participate? Yes, the student participated. Sign off, hand it in to the enrollment
person.
Now
they're asking, what does that participation constitute?
And yeah. How long are you logged in? And are you? I mean, I know from data that we use to tell us about readers on our website that you can tell whether a person is active when they have a screen up, right? So there's all sorts of ways to do this.
Mm-hmm. There's the technology exists. It's out there. It's mm-hmm. It's easy to use.
Have any other online schools had the problems that ECOT's had? Yes.
Definitely. None of them have been as big as ECOT. Right. I'm forgetting some of the other names right now. But
ECOT's technically the biggest school district in the state.
In the state, yes. That's right. Yeah. And it's a, its founder is a big GOP donor. And it's been interesting to see this evolve because he's a big donor to the legislature. And you asked if the state could just withhold money. The easiest way for the state to just withhold money from them would be for the legislature to explicitly give the state permission to do that in a bill. Mm-hmm. That you sometimes see departments at the state level who are not part of the legislature, so part of the governor's administration or another statewide elected official's office, mm-hmm. say like, well, we don't have the authority to enforce this. This is just the rule. We can't punish someone. We can't this or that. So mm-hmm. that would certainly be the easiest way to make some of these changes. And the legislature is still a little there. If we're going to rank the different Republicans involved in leading Ohio, I think the legislature would be the least on the warpath against ECOT, I guess. But many other statewide officials have. Republicans like the governor's administration and the auditor have come out and basically said, this is just not how we do things here.
Chrissy Thompson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Bureau Chief at the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also, Andy Chow, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Yep. Happy Monday.
And Jessica Wehrman, thank you as well for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. That's it for our weekly Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.